Welcome to the Technori Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Catoon. Joining us on today's show, Ashish Rangnekar. I probably still butchered it. Whatever. Dude is amazing. CEO of Bench Prep, co-founder, CEO of Bench Prep. For those of you who don't know what Bench Prep is, you're going to find out some cool stuff. I didn't know. They were called Watermelon Express. Like, how in the hell do you get that? Like, you'll have to listen to figure it out. But very cool. I mean, it's an example of a company who launches in the edtech space as like a solve a problem for me and my co-founder. Didn't even bother to like start a company. They just went and built an app and tried to put it in the app store, only to find out that they needed to name a company. And they're like, we don't even have a company. What do you want to call it? Which I talked about with him is like, in my mind, there's not enough of that going on. There's too much strategery, as President Bush so coined. It's just a little... I don't know. I hear pitches all day, so sometimes I get jaded. But I'd love to see more founders who, like, the story starts with, we just tried to do this thing, and like, it really wasn't about getting rich or anything. It was just like cool, and we did it. These guys did it. They're pushing, you know, 100 million in revenue, over 70 people working for the company, growing very, very fast. And now you'll get it from him on exactly what all the company does. But the gist is, like, everyone needs training at their office and certifications, and they help you study and prepare for it, which is obviously a growing business. So with that said, I'm looking forward to having that conversation. Before I go to that, though, we got to check that startup inbox. Let's see what we got here. Lydia Chernoff. Okay, Lydia Chernoff. Worry about appearance as a founder. How do I go with this one? Let's start with this. It's trendy for startup founders to wear jeans and a t-shirt with an emphasis on knowledge over physical appearance. But at what point does how I dress and wear matter for business? All right. This one I have to take carefully because, one, we're talking about a female founder. I don't want to say that I would change my opinion based on being a male founder. That's not what I'm saying. But there is sort of like an assumption that male founders, for whatever reason... Maybe it's the beard. I think it's the beard, actually. The beard is the giveaway. The beard already looks like unkempt. It just looks like it already looks like you don't give a shit. And so there's this assumption that if I'm wearing a beard, I can throw on a t-shirt and jeans. No offense to John, producer John here. But it just has this like thing. And I think that this is not okay. But I do think that there's a little bit of a double standard that goes on. And so I'm just going to answer this ubiquitously to everyone. Let's make this very simple. Know your value. This is it. You have the ability to capture this person's attention for 1 minute and lose it or keep it. And it's up to you. And so I think you can have, if you have all the cards, like, one, you should be respectful to everybody. So I'm not saying don't be respectful. But if you have all the money, you've got all the cards, you're the one who they came to see. Yeah, you can. I'm not saying you should, but yeah, you can be a little late. You could show up in gym clothes. Like, who gives a shit, man? Like, you're here for me, and this is the way that I could present myself to you today. This is the window of time that I made available. Okay? They have that luxury. That is the right of the person who's got all the power. On the other hand, if you're the person asking for something, regardless of who you are, gender, sex, all this stuff, doesn't matter. What matters is that you understand your audience. And you know what they want and what they like and what they appreciate. And I'll tell you something. If you appreciate authenticity and you don't like people who want to put on airs, then my guess is when you show up and you dress however you dress and they don't respond well to it and they wish that you would have dressed the way they want you to dress, you probably shouldn't be in business with them in the first place. Don't do business with people that you don't align with. This is like a really weird way to answer this, but it's a true. Know your value. If you're the one bringing the value, you can do whatever the hell you want within reason. If you're not, then you have to make a choice. Do I want to be authentic or inauthentic? And if it's all about money and bucks and deals, then you chase that. And that means sometimes you got to swallow your pride. Sometimes you don't. Lydia, I don't know if I answered the question. I just went off on a rant here, but you get the gist. So anyway, this Startup Inbox is sponsored by ActiveCampaign. Go beyond email marketing with true automation by signing up at activecampaign.com/technori. Get your first 2 months for free. I can tell you, we are using it. We're now like 2 months into it. Unbelievable. Totally, like, hate CRMs passionately. Love this CRM. I actually use the app on my phone. That's how much I enjoy the Deal app on my phone. So you should definitely check it out. Okay. On to the show. Ashish, CEO of Bench Prep. I was saying before when you came in here, this is like Bench Prep Technori Day. We've got Ajwal is on a panel with myself, and I have spoken with him before at Tech Week a few times. And I feel like I've met you once before at something, and I don't recall what it was, but I've been a huge fan of Bench Prep forever, and Technori obviously has been a huge fan of Bench Prep forever. So it's just really cool to have you in here and to learn like where everything has gone and how Bench Prep has evolved. Cause I feel like the company that it launched as and where it's at now, like, is it the same? Is it different? Like what are we looking at when we look at Bench Prep? Cause it's a gem here.
We have evolved dramatically. And I mean, first of all, I would say that big fan of Technori. I'm glad we are doing that. And I almost think that for the last kind of few years, we have been kind of focused and just kind of, you know, heads down working. And I'm glad that we are talking today so that we can actually begin to tell our story. And you're right. I mean, Ujjwal and I have been doing this for almost 10 years now. I mean, this is like we started in 2008. And for the first couple of years, it was just a project of like two guys working on an app kind of a thing. And then the first inning was us trying to figure out what's the B2C or direct-to-consumer model. And we did that for 4 years. And the second incarnation of the company has been the B2B model for the last 4 years or so. And it's only when we actually moved to B2B that things actually started to work.
Yeah.
So I almost feel like, you know, it has been 10 years and I'm already on my third startup with Bench Prep.
So this, I think it'd be kind of fun to do this. And if you remember this, which I have very, very much doubt that you forget this, if you could give me the pitch of what Bench Prep is when you started it and what Bench Prep is today, give me that pitch. I want to hear the pitch that you would have made to me as an investor day one.
Let's try to do that. I think the funny thing is it has been the same thing, but we pitch it differently.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's do that. So, by the way, funny story. When we started, and actually the legal name of the company is still Watermelon Express. So
is that a public thing to people? They're going to find out now. But
oh, yeah, it's a public thing. I mean, for the first 4 years or 5 years, we operated as Watermelon Express.
What is the derivation of that? Like, how did that, where does Watermelon Express come in? Is that part of the pitch, or is that just like, that's the name we did?
It all came back to me because when we started, we were pitching Watermelon Express. I mean, that was the company that we were pitching. I mean, Bench Prep is kind of the B2B version of it. I mean, the name came in because when we started the company, it started off as an app. I mean, this was an app for GMAT prep. I mean, this is something that I was going through where I was a professional working in New York City and I was preparing for my GMAT exam because I wanted to go back to graduate school to do my MBA.
Yep.
And the options that were available to me were actually not something that I was excited about. So either I can buy a book and, you know, pay $20, so inexpensive.
I did the LSAT thing, so I'm with you on this.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was horrible.
Absolutely terrible.
You lug around the books and you had to like sneak into a conference room and study. And I mean, it was a horrible experience. Right? On the other hand, I could spend $1,000 and walk into a classroom program.
Yep. Right?
That expected me to kind of come in every Tuesday evening, 6 p.m.
Ready to go. Right?
And I didn't want to kind of, you know, go to a classroom, and I was traveling all around. It just kind of didn't fit my lifestyle.
Yep.
So Ujjwal and I got together and I said, let's build an app for it. And that's how it all began. And so the first product that we launched was a GMAT prep app. So here we are, you know, two of us, and we're like, okay, we'll build an app, and that's another story and we'll get into that. But what do we name the app? So we said, well, it's for GMAT, so we should have a GMAT name on it. And then there is a mobile express component to it. So why don't we call it GMAT Express? And we're like, sure, that's a good name. Let's do it. So we build an app and we open up an account with Apple as a developer account, and we upload the app, and we're uploading the app, and it goes like app name, like GMAT Express, company name. And then I look at Ujjwal and be like, what's our company name? So we didn't even think about what the company name is going to be. And that just speaks to the fact that...
And 10 years of your life later.
here we are.
Don't even have it.
But this just shows that it wasn't like Ujjwal and I were sitting together and figuring out what's the business model, right? How are we going to raise capital? What the company, what is it going to be called 10 years from now? It was just two of us trying to solve a problem that we saw in our lives.
Right? I think, and then we're going to do the pitches.
Yeah.
We'll like, I think this, and by all means, speak up if you disagree. I think this is one of the problems, like, by and large, the numbers for Chicago VC is very strong. It's the top of the country in returns to VC at 8x, and female entrepreneurs are even, you know, higher than that, which is really cool. But I still think that, like, one of the biggest problems in the startup community, not just Chicago but abroad, is that there are less stories like yours. There are not enough. I think of the stories that you know, you hear it if you listen to Shark Tank and all this other garbage. You hear the story of, like, the ubiquitous you know, solve a problem that I had, so that's my thing, right? But it's like forced. It's not,
yeah,
it's not organic. You don't have a story of, like, I literally can't get fundraising, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to create this and it's going to do this. And then, like, company. Well, I didn't even think about that. Like,
yeah,
it wasn't a company. I think some of the most successful companies that we have in this city are companies like yours. And the people who come in here and tell me the story, it's like that. I feel like maybe it's all of the I call it struggle porn, but, like, all the stuff on YouTube and stuff, people talking about how to be an entrepreneur has, like, ruined the organic nature. And I think that that impacts the success of the companies a lot, because, like, I think yours is like a journey that sort of paint by numbers, and you just sort of, like, figure it out as you're going along. Yeah. You know, it's
I agree. I mean, I think things are much more organic than what people make them believe.
Yeah.
And we can go on and on about even the most successful companies that were actually not started off with a extremely clear kind of vision or business plan in mind.
Yeah.
I mean, on a completely sidetrack, I'm actually kind of listening to an audiobook, Shoe Dog by Phil Knight. I mean,
okay.
The founder of Nike.
Yeah, it's a great book.
And, you know, we think of Nike as this, like, amazing brand, like, marketing driven. I mean, they know how to kind of, you know, put the brand out. When he started Nike, I mean, he was essentially a reseller of a Japanese shoe company.
Yep.
I mean, he wasn't like a marketing guru or, you know, none of that. I mean, he was literally selling shoes that he was importing from Japan. And one thing led to another. And he just made the best of what was given to him. And now Nike is kind of, you know, the best and the biggest.
$85
ever.
A share.
Yeah.
But no, so to your point, though, like, I feel like, don't get me wrong. Like, I think I am a fan of founders who find... I always talk about the unfair advantage. I love founders that find an unfair advantage that they can, like, I don't want to say exploit. And they identify that this is potentially a quick flip exit. There's potentially acquirers here. So I'm, like, following a business plan. Like, this is very, very direct. I like that. But I think that sometimes we, like, try to force people into this box.
Yeah.
Where, like, so I have, well, you guys know these guys well, Lightbank. I have Vic Piscucci on the show all the time. And he's the one who actually kind of coined the unfair advantage phrase for our show. And one of the things he said is like, I make a mark of it, like, within the first 5 minutes of a conversation. Founder idea. So I look at the set of founders and it's like, are these people who I just think, I don't know if this is the idea that they're going to crush, but they're going to crush something. I can just tell.
Yeah.
And I wonder if we've gotten to a point where, because of all the numbers, because of the metrics, because of the data, the need for it and the explanation, the ROI and everything, that a lot of angels and VCs have focused in very hard on a couple of ideas and think fintech, blockchain, things that, like, are hot and have, like, ignored the individuals that are just, like, solving a problem and going about it in organic nature. I feel like they don't get nearly enough attention.
It's possible. And see, I mean, if you look at the VC model, right, the VC model is to find the 2 out of 100 companies that are going to return their fund. Right? So at some point, there is slight difference between what an entrepreneur would want and what VC company is looking for, right?
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I mean, I think from an entrepreneur perspective, it's a bad idea to focus on an idea that they think VCs would want to invest in. I mean, that's the worst thing that
you're going to have no passion behind it. And when things slide out, you're going to not know where to go.
Because things would always slide out.
Yes.
I mean, I can assure you that that things would go wrong. And what comes to rescue is your passion. And that's the only thing that's going to drive your perseverance that you would need to succeed in the long run.
Well, yeah, because they're not paying you, like, an exorbitant amount of money to test theories.
Yeah.
So, like, literally, if you think that you're coming into this thing as, like, I'm going to get a bunch of money to, like, go pursue this, when the money dries up, it's still you grinding through the middle of the night and, like, making sacrifices to make it work. So,
yeah,
totally get that.
Because I think when I look at companies around me in Chicago and the companies that have succeeded, I can go on and kind of talk about how at one point in their life cycle, they had to pivot. Maybe it wasn't like business model, maybe it was, you know, pricing, maybe it was pivot around how they actually managed their, you know, leadership team or brand or whatever that might be. But never ever you kind of make a plan and it always happens the way it was meant to be.
Well, let's prove that theory. So originally you started this as GMAT Express under the name of Watermelon Express, right? So then it becomes Bench Prep. And now you've got the 2019 pitch. So let's have the 2019. What is Bench Prep?
So 2019 pitch is, we are a learning platform company and we are on a mission to enable today's education and training companies digitally transform themselves so that they can first survive and thrive in the world of online learning. We live in a world where today's modern learner is very different. Right. They are distracted. They get too many Slack messages, too many emails, too many text messages. They are impatient. They can't watch a video any longer than 10 minutes. They're untethered. They want things to be gamified and personalized to them. But when you look at these education and training companies that have been around for 30, 40, 50 years, who have been delivering training to this modern learner, they don't have the right platform to deliver that. They're still pushing books and ebooks and classroom training programs, and there is this disconnect. So we are helping these companies deliver these best-in-class learning programs and making it insanely easy for the learner to consume these programs.
So let me ask you a couple questions. So we obviously talked to a lot of startups, and we had a group in yesterday. Now, they're more focused on like the marketing and marketing tech and education around bringing tech to marketing folks in particular.
Mm-hmm.
One of the conversations sort of spun out of it, and I'm not going to name them because I was honest to them in the meeting. I'm not saying I wasn't honest to them, but I left out a few layers of the conversation because I knew I was talking to you today, and I just had this feeling in my head that like I could make them not pursue their dreams by telling them the truth. And I was like, it's not far enough along to tell you to like kill it. I don't know everything.
Yeah.
But this, what you guys have built, and you talk about the pivots and the pains, what you guys have gone through is like, to me, sort of the, what's the right word here? Adulting. Like, it's the adult version of what an ed tech company has to look like. And there's this misconception that I can like host some events and host some classes and I can localize and have like offices all over and we'll go to big businesses and we'll help train their team.
Yeah.
And that's scalable. And like, in a sense it is, because it's a headcount, right? So like in your brain, it's scalable. In reality though, not scalable.
No.
Because you've got to have the digital component. You've got to have metrics built into it that the businesses can go, how many times did these people go? How much did they learn? How did their performance increase? There's so much technology that goes into it. And I didn't have the heart to tell them that like what you're doing is very cool. And they kept using the term general assembly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I kept like semi-cringing because I'm like, there's just so much more to you know, that you just don't get.
See, but I think, I mean, at some point you need to tell those entrepreneurs, right?
I wasn't in the spot to do that yesterday.
If
they were asking me for money, I would. This was advice, and it was my advice was like, and they're early into this, like this isn't just, you know, just me, like they're really literally like, we're gonna pursue this, we've got some people doing classes, and this is kind of the Phil Knight Nike story in a sense. Like, I don't know if they know what they're going to need to do to get to the next level, but they're early enough now that they could make a nice little business out of it locally.
Yeah, but see, that's the point.
But that's not my call, call to tell them.
The thing is, it's okay that not every business has to be a $1 billion business.
Correct.
Right? Not every business has to kind of, you know, get to 100 million in revenue.
Right? Yep.
But the entrepreneur need to make that decision early on. And it's funny, when I look back, there were people who told us, I guess not enough, but there were enough. There are a few people who told us that the B2C business model isn't really scalable. And we were just like, you know, arrogant and adamant about it. Yeah. So now when I get...
Well, that's because you actually had the problem. You saw it firsthand of what it is, and the fact that when you went searching for solutions, there was none.
Yes.
And so, like, I'm assuming these were investor types who said that this isn't scalable.
Yes.
When's the last time? I guess if they were taking a series or something, I don't know what would have been the last... Getting their broker dealer license, I don't even think they have that. Yeah, like, would be the last time that they had to struggle with this?
15 years ago, right?
And they didn't have the tech to go to an app anyway. So, like, and this is going back to that point we talked about in the start of the show, which is like, you've got to feel the pain for real.
Yeah.
Or it's not, you can't connect with it when you're in the deep woods.
Yeah. But I think the thing is, in our case, the pain was real and the need was there. I think the way we are attacking it with the direct-to-consumer model was not the right model.
Yep.
And it might have been the right model if we wanted to kind of build a company that will get to $10 million in revenue and that is it. Right?
Yep.
Amazing. And I think that's what I push for when I meet entrepreneurs now. I mean, I had a great meeting with an education entrepreneur 2 weeks ago.
Hopefully it wasn't the same one.
No. I mean, very smart guy, extremely passionate, and has a phenomenal product. And I had to kind of, you know, just lay it out to him that, you know, this is a great product, but if it's going to be very difficult for you to build a business which is going to get to $100 million in revenue doing this, which is okay. So just make sure that the decisions that you make right now, don't try to kind of make it into a $100 million company with that product, right? Either if the goal is to get it to 100 million, then change the product or business model a little bit and make it more aligned. Or you just kind of accept the fact that, you know, this is going to be a very good $5 to $10 million revenue company, which is
nothing general, wrong with it.
which is great, and you know it's difficult to build, and it adds a lot of, like, you know, social value. So, you know, do that.
Yeah, and I will say, like, I don't try. It depends on the stage before I say what I say, but like, I will say this though. I always point this out regardless of where the meeting is. If somebody is putting out something where it's very cool, it could be very well adopted, but the cost of making it available far exceeds the cost that someone is willing to pay to have it.
Yeah.
That's the first one where I'm like, right off the bat, like I'm just going to tell you right now, there's a reason that this doesn't exist at $1 billion. Like, it just doesn't happen.
Exactly.
But I want to spin forward here with you a little bit to building a $100 million in revenue company. So you get from a point where you guys have to figure out what the name of the business is.
Yeah.
Then you start your B2C model, and it's like you can get some revenue. Maybe that's the fastest path to revenue, but not scalable revenue. Then you end up getting yourself now to this next level where it's like B2B and almost B2B2C in a sense, and which then circles back around and starts promoting your B2C again, because now it's like, well, shit, I use this here. I could probably use it for something else.
Definitely.
Right. So you've got, not necessarily from a business standpoint, but more from a managerial standpoint. How do you start to drive that ship? How do you start to get people to buy into this and go, okay, so like this $10 million company could be a $100 million. Like, how do you start to do that?
So it's gradual. It was gradual in nature. I mean, I think when we did the pivot from B2C to B2B, I think the goal was, we were actually not even trying to solve for 100 million.
Yeah.
We were saying, let's get it to $10, $15, $20 million, right? So everything that I was doing in terms of recruiting, setting up strategy, building the management team, every conversation in the internal all hands meeting or board meeting wasn't to tell the story about 100 million, but let's start with the 10 to 25 million.
Yep.
Because if you can't get to that, then 100 million doesn't really matter, right? And my job was to make sure that everyone was aligned towards this, like, $25 million story. And once that started to happen, and once everyone started to see the value that we were delivering to our customers, and when success started to kind of, you know, happen around us, that's when there was a lot of confidence, right? So then everyone started to believe, this is like 25 million, that's fine. We can kind of get to that point.
Right? Yeah.
And once we got to that point where that ship was sailing well and it was steady state, then we started to kind of open up the market and tell the bigger vision as to what's going to happen in the next 5 years as against next kind of, you know, four quarters.
Yep.
So I think it's much more kind of gradual in nature, at least the way we did it.
So would you, I mean, I guess I look at this and I just think of, like, we've had several companies on here, you know, not really the same thing, but like Alligator Tech, Sid Bala was on here mm-hmm. talking about how like they've literally reinvented the company like three different times. Same CEO, got to get the same people to buy into a new vision. And that's the part I think is interesting, is like, not to get like super, you know, inspirational kind of stuff here, but like, I think that it's one of the biggest challenges that young leaders have. And there's a million reasons why I think this, and it's not just lack of experience. I think it's like a lot less interpersonal, you know, opportunities for younger people. They're not quite as like dealing with the dramas and the responsibilities I think younger people did in the past,
yeah.
you know, getting married earlier and that kind of deal. But I think that they have a very hard time getting people to believe that they can do anything.
Yeah.
And it's like, you hired me, you brought me on to do this. You as a leader, don't ever ask how, you just as when. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't care how, we're going to do it. Like, that's not a question. But to get people to buy into that, but also manage expectation. Because, like, you don't want them to go, you know, bananas and fly through the wall. You need to, like, harness it. How do you get your people to continue to do their daily work, but then also continue to work, you know, exceedingly hard to, you know, sort of, what's the right way to put this? Push the boundaries.
Yeah. No, it's hard. First of all, it's very hard. I mean, every leader has to figure out their own ways to do this. I mean, in my case, I don't think that, I mean, very early on, I realized that I don't want to be the person who is kind of doing these, you know, all hands, inspirational kind of motivational speeches every week to yeah. kind of get the troops rallied.
It wears out quickly.
Yeah. And then it's like, you know, at the end of the day, like, okay, the speech was great, but like what happens when everyone goes back to the desk?
Yeah.
Do they have a plan? Do they have something that they are actually kind of excited about, you know, outside of the speech? So I think what I ended up doing was, you know, there were a few guiding principles that we laid out. And we said, let's agree on these guiding principles. So let's not worry about like the business model and the pricing and who's the next customer that we are kind yeah. of signing. But let's agree on the 3-4 big things that all of us are excited about. Right? They're almost, I would consider like the, you know, these are the 4 pillars of where our company, on what our company is based on.
Can I have you share the pillars, or is that internal?
No, definitely. Yeah.
Whoever's listening, write this down.
So these are the guiding principles that we believe are happening around us, and we'll kind of, you know, get to that. So the first is, we believe that modern learner is very different. Right. So today's learner, as I talked about, is, you know, untethered, and, you know, they want personalized, gamified, and so on. Right. So I want to make sure that I look around the room and I talk to all of my team members and I say, do we agree to that? Right? If we agree to that, then fine. I mean, that's we will do good work if we agree on this kind of first basic guiding principle. Right?
Yep.
Second principle was the fact that we believe that credentials are not going away. Right? So, you know, it's okay to kind of go to YouTube and learn how to make a pizza, or, you know, how to be a Microsoft Excel guru.
Assumed knowledge is not scalable.
Exactly. You need to prove your mastery in that, right? So, you know, I look around the team and be like, do we agree to that? Right? So that's the second one. Third one is the fact that, you know, we need our platform would actually approach this in, you know, a particular way. And I won't kind of go into the details, yeah. but, you know, that's the third one. Fourth one is the fact that education and training companies that are out there and have been out there for the last 50 years are not well equipped to actually solve this problem themselves, right? The fifth one is, although we are in a software business, but at the end of the day, we are in people business,
yeah.
right? And we believe that happy people would make happy software, and happy software would lead to happy outcomes. So these are like
that's like all of these things are like, it's ed tech, it's human, it's as a software company. I think the last one is huge, because I think it's totally true. I mean, I've never seen a good piece of tech built by someone who's unhappy and had a very good outcome. So usually it's glitchy and it ends about halfway because they quit.
Yeah. But see, that's the thing. Some of these things are obvious.
Yeah.
But we want them to be obvious as a group, right? So we want everyone in my leadership team, management team, board, all the way down to an early, like, fresh out of college employee who just started, I want to make sure that they are aware of these guiding principles and they subscribe to them. And once they subscribe to them, then they would know like on every single decision that they're making every day, they want to, they should know that, does it actually align to these five guiding principles? And if it does, then they're ready to rock and roll.
Can I ask you even just a range, like how many employees you manage?
Yeah, so we have roughly around 70 employees right now.
So 70 employees. I look at this and I just think, like, if there's a, you've said a bunch of things today that are like a really, really good takeaway. This one that you didn't say it specifically, but like the way that the messaging came across, the idea that if you want to manage 70 people and try to pursue $100 million in revenue, and in the end, the only thing that would make this successful failure for you is, can I get everyone to buy into just three plus or minus one principles? And then what I'm looking at as a CEO is like, I'm not managing 70 people with 70 personalities chasing 70 independent missions.
Yeah.
I'm managing one mission, three guiding principles, and anyone who is not going in the way of the pack, unfortunately, may or may not work out. Let's assume may not work out. And that keeps everything just much more manageable. And then it's like, you have to delegate to your management team how to control whichever vertical you're looking at. But generally speaking, even they have to adhere to the exact same guiding principles, lest this doesn't work.
Yeah. And not just the management team. It goes all the way to every single employee, because they are, in most cases, it's the frontline team member who is interacting with the customer, right? I mean, we're not going to have our director of sales kind of talk to customer every time. And I want to make sure that even the frontline, like someone in the customer success team, someone on the QA team, someone on the sales operations, everyone is speaking the same language to every single customer.
Mark Lawrence said this when he was in on the Saturday Live WGN show, that his goal, he joked about the fact that he wouldn't want you as a customer to have to talk to him, but like, just because I'm awkward.
Yeah.
But his goal was that every person who hung up the phone felt like they talked to the top.
Yeah.
So the idea being that like every single person at this company has to buy into this mission of being a customer hero, and that our job is to help you navigate what is one of the most frustrating things on the planet, parking. And every person needs to hang up the phone feeling like, I talked to the CEO and he just hooked me up with a spot. And that, like, training his top brass down to the people that they train and that they manage and the people that they then manage and train, and then everyone who gets hired in between, they all have to feel the same way. Otherwise, it doesn't work.
That's very well said. That's empowerment, right? You have to empower every single... I mean, right now, we're only 70, but... will be 100 very quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, very quickly you get to a scale where even layers of management doesn't really help, because the decisions are actually happening at the ground level.
Yep. So. It's very cool. This has been a really fascinating conversation. I hope you got something out of it as well. Where do people go to learn more about Bench Prep?
Benchprep.com.
Very simple.
And follow us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook.
Everywhere at Bench Prep. Before I let you go, we're going to do a little startup showcase. You down?
Yeah, let's
do it. All right, so you can throw your headset on here. So here's how this works. In a couple seconds here, good producer Tom is going to hit the play button. A company is going to call in and pitch a 1 minute, roughly, to pitch their business. And everyone listening can invest in the company on Republic at republic.co/whatever the name of this company is. And I just want to know from you as a founder, and I'm sure you do some angel investing as well. So your take on the company and whether or not you'd be interested in it, and or thoughts just in general.
Let's do it.
Cool. Let's do the little startup showcase.
So Upsonder is connecting the world to drone services. Drones are taking over our world, and Upsonder is building software and infrastructure to make sure that happens quicker. Upsonder's mission, we are deploying a drone anywhere, anytime, for any reason. That's our goal. That's what we strive for each and every day. And today, Upsonder does this with our national marketplace of FAA-certified drone pilots. It's as simple as search and book. And for the future, Upsonder is developing a wireless rooftop charging network to support autonomous drones. Upsonder is going to be the reason why you get your online order in under 15 minutes. And your listeners, they can go to republic.co/Upsonder if they want to learn more or make a direct investment. But it's our job, what we're doing is to make sure that drone services are easily accessible to the masses.
All right. So here's the deal. In case you listeners did not get the whole gist of this, I just want to make sure that it's clear. They're building basically a network for drones to their assumption that they're making is that every person, not every person, but most people will have a drone on the top of their house, and that drone is going to charge on that piece and go back and forth and pick up all these things. and that there's going to be a huge opportunity. So right now what they have is FAA-certified pilots who are flying the drones for you. You need like 24-hour notice to do it. It's not practical, but it's like a get-started-in-the-system kind of thing. And their hope is that sort of like the Tesla supercharger network, that everyone's house will be a parking spot essentially for drones, and that's how it's going to go. Thoughts?
It's actually very interesting. Very interesting. I think let me highlight a couple of things that I really liked about it and a couple of things that I'm struggling with. First is... I think they did a really good job kind of explaining what the product is, or explaining what the value proposition is. I like the fact that, you know, he called it out that a good example is, you know, you'll order something and you'll get it in 15 minutes. Yep. And the quantification was great. The thing that I kind of struggled with was, it's one of those things where I couldn't really, for a little bit, I couldn't understand who the customer was.
Yeah.
Right. So am I the customer? Is it kind of, you know, some, you know, drone services company is the customer? So kind of calling out very quickly who the customer was is going to help. Right? Yep. Second is, I think this entire business is kind of dependent on government authorities allowing this to happen. So it's one of those things where I'm really excited about for this specific kind of, you know, thing to happen, and I think they can pull off from a product perspective, but they're kind of dependent on this third party, you know, FAA to allow this to happen. So I think I would say that this is
ambitious.
I mean, it's I would worry about the externality in this, in terms of, you know, their dependence on the FAA or some regulatory body allowing them to do this.
So I agree with you. I said this to him on the show on Saturday. I think it's a real estate play to me, actually. Like, the drone thing is, it could be whatever, but I look at it like getting in a partnership with the FAA and making available and making money from people basically using their real estate as a parking spot. So, like, we'll create a network of places where a bunch of drones could park and that they can be used for Amazon. Because one of the things he said that I got lost on was that when we, and I could be wrong here, but when we think of the drone universe, we always think of Amazon sending drones to drop things off for me, Walgreens sending drones to drop things off for me, FedEx sending drones to drop. We never think of me sending drone to pick something up.
Yeah.
I don't think of it that way.
Yeah, I don't either. But I think, I mean, that's going to be very hard.
So, like, what if you remove that part of the question and you said, we're going to create landing zones where the drones can park and fly and move from? You don't own it.
Yeah.
But, like, Amazon might own it, or somebody else might own it, or it's a rental drone. It's autonomous, and they just go where there's point A to point B. It's a pickup zone. I'm not saying this is going to be any better of an idea than the original idea, but the idea of simplifying it and saying, okay, FAA, I don't want to get into this question about, like, whether or not we have clearance to fly.
Yeah.
I'd rather be like, do we have clearance to land and take off? Yeah. I don't care about the rest of it. Like, let me give you a network of places for drones to, because they also have to charge.
Yeah. Yeah.
For drones to charge and park all over the country. And I help facilitate what infrastructure.
I like that much, much, much better, because let the Amazons and the Walmarts of the world deal with FAA in terms of what are the regulations, in terms of,
they got the right sway.
Yeah, and like, what height can they fly on, and like all of that stuff. But as a consumer, I'm just allowing, it's like a parking spot.
Yeah. I mean, maybe I spend too much time in Chicago. We have way too many parking apps. There's so many. So maybe it's just like, that's my intuition. But anyway, this has been just honestly one of the better interviews we've done. Ashish, I appreciate you taking the time. I love the progress that Bench Prep has had. I hope that we can continue to do some stuff together.
Absolutely.
And in general, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks a lot for having us and sharing our story.
Of course, anytime. We'll be doing more of that this evening. Mm-hmm. People will not hear this part because this will have already happened before you hear this podcast, but know that we had a wonderful time and the panel undoubtedly went very well. You can learn more about upcoming Technori events and investment opportunities. Check out the blog on technori.com, download the podcast on Spotify, follow us on social at Technori, or you can follow me at Katoon. Boom, that's a wrap.